This is Austin, and you're listening to the LL Research Radio Program In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Wednesday, April 30th, 2014. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Gary and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community, and towards this end has two websites. The archive website, llresearch.org, and the community website, bringforth.org. Together, they offer over 1,300 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on the air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Austin, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. Is everybody with us and ready?
We're here.
Where you are.
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, we can jump right into the opening riff, which comes from a Quo session from June 29th, 1988. Quo says, "The most basic passion, one of the most clear in the mind of each here, is sexual, physical passion. Because the body cannot speak, it is most often true within your illusion that true passion is felt in this way, rather than in an intellectual or spiritual manner. This is as it should be, for it is the cornerstone of your carefully contrived illusion that physical passion shall bring people together."
Thanks, Austin. In this reading, Quo identifies passion as having two basic components, purified emotion and free will. This isn't the only place where the centrality of the will is pointed out, but it is a place where it is shown how important it is that we get hold of our will and point it in the direction we want it to go. Naturally, we all love sexual passion. Almost all of us do. Just the sheer experience of it without any bells and whistles is great. I've always wondered what people mean by bad sex. I mean, you can have not great sex, certainly, but beyond my experience. Exquisitely beautiful sex, on the other hand, is part of my experience, and I'm very grateful to those few men in my life who have worked with me patiently and skillfully to share an energy exchange not only of the body, but of the mind and of the spirit. I've often talked about my ideal for a date. You know, it can have a nice long prologue, like going to the movies, having a pizza, you know, talking together. But somewhere there should be brought up anything that's between the two of you that would keep you from wholeheartedly giving yourself mind, body, and soul to your mate. You should talk about it. Otherwise, you'll never have sacred sexuality. You'll never be able to share from the indigo ray unless you have shared blue ray, honesty and truth. It's not that easy to share those things. Sometimes honesty bites. It has a tough, tough beginning to it. You don't want to hear it. You want it to go away. It hurts. And then you buckle down and you do the work. That really hurts when you say that. And you make the mate see how much that honesty did hurt, so that the mate has sympathy for you and realizes the extent to which you have to go in order to be one. Possible, because Jim and I do it all the time. We did it yesterday, coming up to the date that we had last night. There was something between us. Not important. It was totally minimal, and it was unimportant by any between us, and so we worked it out. And the wellsprings of love just overflowed for us when we did that, the way they always do. And we are not different than anybody else. It only takes a will linked with that purified emotion that comes from loving someone for a long time, or perhaps for a short time, but intensely. Sexuality can never be overestimated in its importance, as Kuo said. The opportunity that it gives us to be of service is really unparalleled. And the opportunity to experience love is a wonderful thing. But there are bells and whistles. And without them, I think the heart starves over the long haul. The self to keep relationships strictly in the uncommitted range, no matter how pleasant that state is for us. Without something between the two of you that is completely understood as being a beautiful thing, as being a desirable thing, as being something we are proud to offer the Creator. We are lacking an open heart at the very time when we want to offer it the very most. Encourage all of us to honor those relationships that we have with the very highest and best of our will and our emotion, in order that we may dance in the fields of the Lord and offer the experience to it. It is a glorious thing to do. The energy exchange is so sweet, powerful. I sometimes wonder if it's that energy that has kept me alive all these years. It sounds silly in a way, but in another way, no, not at all. It's an enormously powerful force in my life, and I'm so grateful for it. Come from the intellect. This comes from my heart. Blessings to all of you. May you have the enormous good experience of energy exchanges that move up the chakras into the open heart. And from the open heart into sacred sexuality. Hand in hand with truth and honesty. It is not an easy task. May you have the joy of it. Amen.
Thank you, Carla. Moving on to our questions for the day. First question comes from Thea, submitted through the Bring Forth forums. Thea asks, this question has to do with the Kuo quote for April 14th, taking disturbing energy inside oneself and healing it. Is there a more nuts and bolts instruction available? I get the oneness of us all. I just don't understand the how-to of it. Sending love and light to the Creator, I can recognize the feeling that bounces back. Is there a feeling associated with the process Kuo recommended? And I have the referenced quote here that I'll read. Kuo said, "What we generally recommend to entities is that when something within their environment disturbs them, they take that within their heart and find that energy within themselves. And then they heal it within themselves. They come to understand it, to experience it without judging it, and to ask it to work for the light within them. In this way, anger becomes stubbornness, the ability to stick to a plan, the ability to continue to love, and so forth. It is the work of a lifetime to interiorize, bless, and redeem the shadow side of the self which is outpictured in the shadows of your planet, its people, and its behavior at the personal level and at the level of nation states and all levels in between. But it is work which you will find to be very rewarding, because as you reduce the distortions within yourself, as you become more balanced and able to see love, hope, faith, and consolation, so you are more able to offer to those whose eyes you meet an awareness of them as loved, consoled, and forgiven."
Well, I can offer some thoughts on this.
Okay, let's start with you, Carla.
All right. There is a practice which is part of kahuna magic, Hawaiian magic, which involves healers taking a file. I mean, they are trained. They are, you know, in the business of being psychologists at a mental institution, say. What the example that I read was a guy at a mental institution who all of the people of which were prisoners. Okay, so some of them were unable to behave in a way that was appropriate. Consensus reality. Some of them simply had to take their medicine in order to stay quiet, because otherwise they themselves or others, they just babbled and hurt themselves and others. And, you know, I don't know. There were different ways in which people had departed the fix outbound, as a pilot would say, leaving the ways of humanity to one side and going off into the wilderness of the chaos of uncontrolled emotion. So this guy, although, as I said, he was trained as a clinical psychologist, chose to do his healing in the following way. He would take the file of the prisoner, read his history, his social history, his mental history, his medical history, picture of a good snapshot of the guy. And then he would sit in his office and go into a deep meditation. He would find the place in himself closely as possible resembled this guy's psychosis. Maybe he was a killer. Maybe he was this or that. So he would find the killer within himself, say. Good example. And then he would work to heal himself. Coming to understand more and more deeply the nature of this shadow side, bring it into his heart and forgive it. Now, how do you forgive a killer? Well, you forgive a killer's soul. You forgive the entity's essence and regret the behavior. And you find work to do in the light, in positivity, that uses that energy that makes a killer a killer. And then you bring that completely into your heart, and it is healed and redeemed and forgiven by you, and you have brought another part of your shadow side into the light. Okay, at that point, he would put the folder down. His work with that prisoner was done, and he would go to the next one, and he would do the same thing. Now, obviously, this took time, and he took it. That was what he did day after day. Amazingly, the statistics showed that of the people that he worked with, in his mind only, in his heart only, never seeing them, never meeting them face to face, those who would not take their medicine began taking it. Those who insisted on acting out, stopped doing that, began to be either in the prison, and so forth. The statistics showed that this method worked pretty amazingly. It worked. And I think that is the kind of thing that the KUO group was talking about. He was basically talking about an aspect of the balancing process. And because of the fact that Jim has this more carefully and with a lot more depth than I have, I would just like for Jim to bring people through the balancing process. Mickey?
Okay. First, I wanted to add a little bit to what you had to say about the kahuna practice. I think this is similar to what Ra had to say about some planetary entities, social memory complexes, do nothing but send love to disturb places like planet Earth.
Yes.
They don't send it in particular to any one person or group. They send it to the planet itself so that it can be used by whomever needs it. And I think that if we, in our individual lives, come across a situation where there is a large group of people, say, maybe like right now in Ukraine with the Russian population of Ukraine attempting to crane toward Russia, as the Crimean area was.
Yes.
We might be able to aid that situation by sending love to them. And in order to do that, we would need to think of ourselves as more than we usually do, as more than we usually are, as a small individualized person contained within this body of skin and bones. We would need to, say, in meditation, rise up out of that body and identify with a larger self, perhaps our higher self, perhaps the planetary spirit, perhaps the spirit of the race that is having the difficulty. And from that point of view, then, begin to send the love and the light that we feel moving through our being. It's helpful to go through, similar to what Carl was talking about in preparing for sexual energy exchange, clearing of the energy centers before such a practice is undertaken, to balance the self in such a way that you can begin to channel forth energies through your being, not from your being, but through your being, and send them forth to where they might be needed. And in order to do that balancing, we have to look at our daily round of activities and see what comes up for us as in need of our attention. And usually that is signified, Ross suggested, by either feeling a great distress towards something in our, or some sort of distress towards some catalyst in our experience of the day, or even great joy towards something in our experience of the day. So at the end of the day, which I think is the best time to do these types of balancing, we look at what either moved us in a positive sense significantly or in a negative sense significantly away from what we might hope to have as a normal state of being. And for this, Ross suggested that feeling a natural compassion for the creation is a normal state of being from which to move, feeling a natural compassion for those around one. So that anything that would move you away from that, either in a positive sense or a negative sense, would be looked at as needing some balance. So you look at whichever way it went. Usually in the negative sense is what catches our attention more, so we look at that. And once again in the meditative state, we allow that experience to be repeated. But not just repeated, but we begin to accentuate it, to intensify it, as if we were putting a magnifying glass on it, and to make it bigger, bigger, and bigger, until it's outrageously large. Until whatever it was, whether it was jealousy, a misunderstanding, anger, whatever, until it's just very, very large and ridiculously large. And then for the next few moments, we just sit and allow that feeling to be without judging it, without working with it. Just what usually occurs is we begin to feel the polar opposite rise up within our consciousness. And as that occurs, then we allow that to also get as large and ridiculously large as the first emotion with which we are working. And then we sit with both of them in the meditative state, neither judging nor attempting to do anything to, just feeling them. And then we accept ourselves for having both of these means by which the Creator can know itself contained within our being. So this also takes us to a place where we are more than our daily personality, more than the way we identify ourselves and the way we present ourselves to others. We look perhaps from the magical personality or the higher self, which Ross said are basically the same thing. And we allow this greater portion of ourselves to move into our being and to do this balancing with us. And then we accept ourselves for having both of these ways, for knowing the Creator and for the Creator to be able to know itself through us in this particular way. So in this balanced sense, then, we become clear and able to channel loving, healing, forgiving, all compassionate energy through us, usually through the heart. If we are balanced through our energy centers, red through violet, the heart is usually that area which is used for healing, and the throat or blue chakra for clear communication, and the indigo ray for magical intent, changing consciousness according to the will. So when we're working with healing and seeing situations outside of ourselves that are not as we feel they should be in order for love and compassion to be able to move freely and for free will to be able to express itself and for people to be able to be in harmony one with the other. So once having done that, then we can focus our energies towards, say, the difficulties in the Ukraine or the difficulties in our community, in our family, in ourselves. Okay.
Okay, that's beautiful. That's exactly what I was hoping for. And that is first established in, as a practice in the first book of, as far as I know, the Law of One, the Ra Group's channeling through me when Don asked questions.
Yeah, sessions 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah.
Thank you. Gary, do you have anything to add to this?
I think that Carla and Jim covered the bases really well. Just a slight nuance to offer, and that's that when experiencing disturbing energies, in my understanding in terms of the how to bring them into yourself, again, I think Carla and Jim covered the bases really well, but I would add that anything you experience in your day-to-day activities, anything, whether how near or far away, has a point of contact within you. So my entry point into performing that, bringing the disturbing energy inside of you, would be to locate where you feel this, whether it's manifesting as a bodily sensation, some kind of interior tension, or a particular thought or a feeling that you're having, or a memory it evokes. Something is happening inside of you in relation to what you perceive as being outside of you. So find it there, wherever it may be, in mind or body or spirit, and then go forward with the type of exercises that Jim was recommending. First and foremost, especially, just witnessing that, being with that catalyst, and as Jim was saying, observing it in a non-judgmental sort of attitude, just really being with that. And that, in my thinking, creates a sort of space wherein love and compassion and acceptance can flow, and where you can see that catalyst as part of yourself. That's my one addition.
Well, that's really good. How about you, Austin?
Yeah, I've always been really surprised how closely the raw material itself relates to the work of Carl Jung, which I'm a really big fan. And also Kuo, almost everything Kuo says I feel like could be related to Carl Jung's ideas. And this is, Kuo even uses the word shadow. This is really close to what Jung calls the shadow work.
Huh.
And finding those things that we do not find acceptable. We see them outside of ourselves, but we know that the outside is really a reflection of the inside. So if there's something outside of us that is bugging us, then it's asking us to look inside to that part and to accept it. And so if you have any more questions, Thea, there's tons of books written by both Jung or people who have interpreted Jung, because he was a very intellectual writer and sometimes difficult to read. But if you search for shadow work kind of books, there's lots of different other techniques. But I think that the raw materials balancing technique that Jim described is probably the best that I've ever come across. The basic shadow work, I think, is balancing the lower three chakras. And Carl Jung might help shed more light on the idea of the shadow work for you. So I think we've pretty thoroughly covered that question.
Oh, everything I know.
All right. Okay. Our next one comes from user Storm Shadow on the Bring Forth forums. Storm Shadow says, Metcalfe's law regarding the value of telecommunications networks states, the value of a telecommunications network is proportional to the square of the number of connected users of the system. This is eerily reminiscent of the law of squares in calling confederation entities for assistance. Could the power of our call be a function of the network we create when calling, in that the call isn't only outward, but simultaneously to each other? And can this connection be developed and used? Is our power as radiators of light and love amplified further by conscious attempts to form a spiritual network? And if so, how might that network be best and most safely formed? I'll shed a little bit of light on what Storm Shadow is referring to in the raw material with the law of squares. Ra said at one point, the service available for our offering to those who call us is equivalent to the square of the distortion slash need of that calling divided by or integrated with the basic law of one and its distortion, indicating the free will of those who are not aware of the unity of creation. Later on, Don is asking for examples, saying, if only 10 entities on Earth required your services, how would you compute their calling using the square rule? And Ra says, we would square 1/10 sequential times, raising the number to the 10th square. And I think this is a bit where Ra may not have been very good at math or using math terminology. Jim made a joke a couple weeks ago about how Ra can't count past 1, which when Ra says square here, the only thing that we are able to figure out based on their example later, they give the number of 10 entities calling would equal that of 1,012 entities calling, basically, using the law of squares, is if instead of squaring, you simply multiply the number by 2 each time somebody joins the calling. So 1 times 2 would be 2, and then if a third person joined, you'd multiply 2 by 2 again, and it would be like 4. The next one would be 8, and then 16, and then 32, so on and so on. So it's not exactly the same as Metcalfe's law, because in Metcalfe's law, it would be 10 users on a network would be equal to 100, whereas 10 people calling would be closer to 1,024 or so.
Just roughly.
Yeah, roughly. and to add to that, Ra did say the entities who call are sometimes not totally unified in their calling, and thus the squaring may be slightly less. So it's never a perfect number. But the statistical loss over the period of a call is basically fixed by the squaring mechanism. So, Gary, I think you had something to add to this?
Yeah, I'm looking. I had never heard of this Metcalfe's law prior to this question, so looked it up. Austin and I both looked it up on Wikipedia, and Wikipedia had a couple interesting things to say about it. And though I totally agree with Austin that there's not a one-to-one correspondence between this Metcalfe's law and the law of squares that Ra discusses, I think examining the question, examining this particular law could yield some insight into the law of squares and group work and calling, etc. So about Metcalfe's law, Wikipedia says, and I think this, I found this elsewhere on a Princeton website, so, the law has often been illustrated using the example of fax machines. A single fax machine is useless, but the value of every fax machine increases with the total number of fax machines in the network. because the total number of people with whom each user may send and receive documents increases. Likewise, in social networks, the greater number of users with the service, the more valuable the service becomes to the community. And then one more paragraph that also, I think, shed some insight. There's a paragraph on limitations, and it says, in addition to the difficulty of quantifying the, quote, value of a network, the mathematical justification for Metcalfe's law measures only the potential number of contacts, i.e., the technological side of a network. However, the social utility of a network depends upon the number of nodes in contact. If there are language barriers or other reasons why large parts of a network are not in contact with other parts, the effect may be smaller. So those two ideas from Metcalfe's law bring to my mind two ideas that I think also are associated with the law of squares. And one is that there is an increase of power when you increase the number of fax machines or the number of nodes in contact in a social network, because there's more exchange, there's more potential to do work, and there's more one person's power is now added to another person's power. So there's more power available to achieve something together. The more in concert and the more unified you're acting, the greater that power, the greater effect that power will have. And the other insight that came to my mind was also the idea of that we've seen expressed in the phrase, more than the sum of the parts. That whether, as described by Metcalfe's law or the law of squares, when X number of people come together, and especially so as there's more X's, something greater emerges that is more than the sum of the individual parts. Mm-hmm. And this connects in my mind also to what Ra described as can happen with the mass mind. In session 3, question 10, Ra says, in speaking about faith, they say, in the first case, only one individual purified of all flaws could move a mountain. In the case of mass understanding of unity, each individual may contain an acceptable amount of distortion, and yet the mass mind could move mountains. And again, this mass mind achieving something together by their combined, maybe even exponentially combined power, I think is spoken to in Metcalfe's law, and even more so in the law of squares.
And we at L&L Research have long been a fan of this law. We started the Gaia Meditations, or the Gaia Meditations, shortly after 9/11. And now, as far as we know, it's all around the globe. That at 9 o'clock, subjectively, you know, wherever that is for you, you sit for just a little short meditation, asking for help for the planet, asking for contact, connection with nature and her beautiful mothering of us, and, you know, just appreciating that and being grateful for every moment. And, you know, it doesn't take much, but when a lot of people are doing it, it makes a stir in the metaphysical world. And we have heard from people again and again who have said, thank you for the work that you're doing with the Gaia Meditations. It's important. You know, you're really accomplishing something. And we don't know that we're accomplishing something. It's all unknown to us physically. But I do believe that we make a difference. And if you want to start meditating, join up. There's a section on our site about the Gaia Meditations. Interesting factoid, how that got started was 3 weeks before 9/11. I got a frantic call from a fellow named Bruce Perret. Some of you may have heard of his work with Dewey Larson's group. He's a great fan of that system of physics and has long been trying to promote it in the mainstream physicists. Well, anyway, he is also very sensitive, and he sits every night, according to him, in meditation. And he wrote me saying that he couldn't get hold of Mother Nature, and he was always in touch with her. And she and he had very cordial relations, and she refused to talk to him. She said, no. And he said, why? And she said, well, it's becoming pretty obvious to us that your planet is not interested in working with us. And if they're not interested in working with us, why should we be interested in talking with them? So Bruce said, you've got to do something, Carla. Like, right, I'm going to be able to do something. Well, I put my mind to it, and the only thing that I could come up with was this rule, this law of squares or law of networks or whatever. If several people get together on one cause, it's much more effectively prayed for. And so I asked people to join us, and Jim and I sit for just a few minutes, not long, in meditation around 9 o'clock every night. We don't miss it too often. And we invite you to join us.
The website where you can find more information about that meditation is bringforth.org/Gaia. And that will take you straight to the information and the quote transcript where they recommend a method. Storm Shadow asked some pretty interesting questions. I think it's a really interesting correlation that he found
yes,
here.
Yes, I do too.
The call being not just outward but also simultaneously to each other, I definitely feel like there's something there when
mm-hmm.
a group makes a call that they are connected on a certain level metaphysically. The way I understand it in time-space is like attracting like, and so when you put out a certain vibration and somebody else is putting out a certain vibration, you're basically brought to each other in time-space.
Yes, I think that's right.
So I'm sure there's definitely something there that when we're brought together in proximity in time-space, that might be how the law of squares functions, how it increases. And Storm Shadow asked if this connection can be developed and used and the safest way to do that. I'm not really sure of any advice on how to develop or use this type of connection. Maybe people who are more aware of time-space and the astral planes can.
Yeah, that would be desirable because I don't think any of the home crew has that kind of sensitivity.
No, not quite. Jim, did you have anything to add to this?
No. I think y'all covered it well.
All right.
Go
ahead, Gary.
I'd say that, like, in terms of how his question about, or Storm Shadow's question, about how to form network, how to increase personal power through the agency of combined power. Very, very, very general parameters. I think, like, Ra talks about X number of people calling Ra. Now, that X number of people aren't getting together at 6:30 Eastern time on a particular day and calling Ra. It's, I think, a function of the quality of their life, the way they are setting their intention, the direction of their work, etc. That, nevertheless, and maybe this gets at what you were saying, Austin, brings them together in a sort of proximity in time space. They share work together without consciously getting together to share work, per se. But if you wanted to, as Storm Shadow is asking, like consciously, intentionally form a network, which I think would have even greater power for those involved in the shared work, very general parameters, I would say, is just find like-minded, like-hearted other people and share activity, set a group task, set a group mission, a group intention, etc., and work together towards whatever the end which is desired by that group. Most especially, work together in silence, to share silence together. I think that's some of the most important group work that can be undertaken, both internally for the group and externally, so to speak, for the planet, for the lightening of the planetary vibration, to share silence. And then I wanted to close my own response by offering a few paragraphs from a book that I thought applied to this topic as well. And it comes from a book called Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell that I started a while back. I didn't finish, but Malcolm Gladwell says, and he's speaking about epidemics here, but you can see the correlation, and not just epidemics in terms of viruses, but in terms of cultural behavior and cultural means, etc. So Malcolm Gladwell says, the second of the principles of epidemics, that little changes can somehow have big effects, is also a fairly radical notion. We are, as humans, heavily socialized to make a kind of rough approximation between cause and effect. We are trained to think that what goes into any transaction or relationship or system must be directly related in intensity and dimension to what comes out. Consider, for example, the following puzzle. I give you a large piece of paper, and I ask you to fold it over once, and then take that folded paper and fold it over again, and then again, and again, until you have refolded the original paper 50 times. How tall do you think that final stack is going to be? In answer to that question, most people will fold the sheet in their mind's eye and guess that the pile would be as thick as a phone book, or, if they're really courageous, they'll say that it would be as tall as a refrigerator. But the real answer is that the height of the stack would approximate the distance to the sun. And if you folded it over on if you folded it over one more time, the stack would be as high as the distance. This is an example of what in mathematics is called a geometric progression. When a virus spreads through a population, it doubles and doubles again until it has, figuratively, grown from a single sheet of paper all the way to the sun in 50 steps. As human beings, we have a hard time with this kind of progression because the end result, the effect, seems far out of proportion to the cause. To appreciate the power of epidemics, we have to abandon this expectation of proportionality. We need to prepare ourselves for the possibility that sometimes big changes follow from small events, and that sometimes these changes can happen very quickly.
That is a challenging paragraph, because I agree. I don't have a concept of epidemics. I mean, pandemics, they have a special word for epidemics that go beyond the bounds of epidemics, you know, more quickly spreading than epidemics, like springing up in more different places all at one time. And they call that a pandemic. But that still doesn't make you feel like you'd go from here to the sun in 50 steps. 50, I mean, that would be pretty giant steps.
Yeah, it's hard to conceive of that proportionality. But it's encouraging, especially for the light worker who looks around on this planet, especially through news outlets, and sees a pretty dire, hopeless situation that never seems to improve.
This is true.
And so it's encouraging to know that you, the person aware of unity and seeking unity, has that sort of power, especially as more and more people tune into that frequency, so to speak.
It's interesting in the raw material, Ross says, that the Confederation in its entire spectrum of entity complexes is called by 632 million of your mind-body-spirit complexes. And that number has been simplified. And when Don asked if Ra could say what the result in the law of squares would be, Ra said that the number is approximately meaningless in the finite sense, as there are many, many digits. So it's sort of an inconceivable calling done by 632 million. Me and Gary were looking on the Bring Forth forums, and somebody had attempted to paste that number into the forums, but even the forums wouldn't accept it. It was so large, it cut off like less 40% of it. So it was just an unimaginable number that from our perspective, just seems indistinguishable from infinity, basically.
Mm.
And so there is a great amount of calling going on at the moment, probably more than that right now.
Oh, I would guess a lot more than in 81, you know, whenever he made that statement, because things have progressed very quickly as far as I could see. I'm very encouraged myself.
Yeah, real quickly, I wanted to draw attention to that thread. I had forgotten about it. It's called Ra's Calling, comma, Law of One, Book One, comma, Law of Squares. Toby initiated it, and Toby was the one to paste that number that Austin described into the forum. And you scroll down and scroll down and scroll down, and it's a big block, and it keeps going. And the forums truncated it at 60% of what the total number is, just to give you a visual of how unimaginable it is. But in response to what Carla was saying about an increase since 81, I recently, last weekend, went to an event that was held on the riverfront in Louisville called Mighty Kindness. And the whole energy, the core energy of the whole event was centered around, let's be kind to one another, let's help make a better world, et cetera. And then there were all sorts of artists and vendors and musicians there on that principal idea. So this is Louisville, Kentucky. Kentucky's politically kind of a red state. I don't know what kind of measurement that is or metric that is. But, you know, Kentucky's definitely not known as a progressive place to be. But nevertheless, in our own backyard, this grassroots sort of stuff is happening.
Yeah, it makes one hope.
All right. We have about 6 minutes left. Probably not time to cover a full question. Unless, I'll just quickly say, is anybody very familiar with the Seth material?
No. I could answer that really quickly because he was basically asking if I was.
Okay.
And I've never read it. I've tried to read it probably a half dozen times. And I go to sleep before I get over one page read. I just nod off. I don't know what it is, but I'm definitely not supposed to read that material. No, I've never read it, and I don't know anything about it except that people that I really respect love that material, and
yeah.
So I can recommend it on their behalf.
To really quickly read the question from Marcel D., who submitted it over email, he says, I have read The Law of One and also your book 101, The Choice, and it has given me much love and understanding of our human nature. I'm also fond of the Seth books, which I feel are very powerful in combination with the raw material, but Seth never speaks about the choice or polarity, service to self or service to others. It has a different focus. I'd like to know if you read or studied the Seth material, and maybe you can tell what density Seth is from. I have a feeling that Seth is late fourth density positive. Jim, do you have any experience with the Seth material?
Yeah, that was the first channel material that I read. And just coincidentally, Jane Roberts suggested that we send our material to the Dawning Company after I communicated with her about it. Seth doesn't talk about polarity, as he says. Seth seems to talk more about just how things work and how much more everyone and everything is than appears on the surface. And just the richness of life that comes when you realize that there are multi-dimensions, that there are parallel realities, that there's your higher self, there's more aspects of yourself, there's your interaction. And that connected with what Ra had to say about if you think a thing or dream a thing, then it does exist in some reality. And Seth talked about all of that. But it is curious that Seth didn't say anything about polarity. I would also guess that Seth is probably positive somewhere in the fourth density, but I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't read a whole lot of the Seth material, but the sense I got was that Seth was more of a, not a higher density, but an inner planes teacher.
Right.
Which might have to do with why they never spoke about polarity, because I think polarity is something the Confederation talks a lot about, but not a lot of inner planes teachers. Gary, anything to add to that one?
Yeah, I had read Eternal Validity of the Soul and the Nature of Personal Reality early on in my 20s and have lost touch and familiarity with it, but I would agree with Austin in that I think it's because they seem to lack this grand overview of evolution and knowledge. Seth seems to lack knowledge of other higher planes of experience, except to say that there are other higher planes of experience, and kind of doesn't get the whole scheme, and that would lead me to believe that there's some highly developed inner planes master, but it's only speculation.
Yeah, we really have no clue.
One thing that I'd like to point out before we leave this is that it's really not much use to try to figure out what planet we came from, what the place that somebody else is in it, in the grand scheme, anything like that, because we haven't walked a mile in their shoes and we don't really have the ability to say, well, this person is, you know, from the fifth sub-density of fourth density because blah, blah, blah. I mean, I think, you know, you could probably make a stab at that kind of thing. But it would always be guesswork unless you knew that person so completely, so thoroughly that you were able to make that determination. I would not feel comfortable in making that determination about anybody else or any other channeled entity, et cetera. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is the content of the material and what kind of you might get out of it personally. And same as you, Carla, I know lots of people who have found a lot of use in the Seth material. And so I definitely feel like it is a positive source of information.
And one quick question for Jim. I know it'll take us over the hour a few seconds, but Jim, I knew you had had you had written a letter to Jane Roberts or Robert Butts. I wasn't sure at the time. But you had sent, in your response to this question, you had mentioned the Donning Company. You had sent the Law of One material to Jane Roberts?
Right. I sent about 10 sessions.
Wow. And so she recommended the Donning publisher, which sent you guys over to Donning.
Right.
Yeah, we got published.
Wow.
For what strange ability of glory that is. Not sure.
Oh, that's just fascinating that Jane Roberts played any part whatsoever in the evolution of the Law of One. But
yeah.
Thanks.
That is interesting. You have been listening to LL Researchers in the Now Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our websites at llresearch.org and bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read the instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/LL. Have a wonderful week. We'll be here next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern and talk with you then.
And we love you all.
I land on an island coast and only flows I see are ghosts. I run through a wooded aisle and chase the sunlight mile after mile. And I feel like I know this place as a tree line breaks in the wide open space. I stare at a bright red sun, search all day, never find anyone. Thank you.
planets turn and the old stars die and the young.